our main speaker for this evening, Marian Kay from Santa Monica.
Thank you. My name is Marianne, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm going to do something with this, or it'll be falling, and I'll be...
Stay.
Thank you so much for inviting me to be here tonight, and a special thanks to Larry, who drove up with Joe and Richard to pick me up, and a special thanks to Damon, who's going to drive me home. I've been driving a car since I was about 31 years old. My sponsor, I called him up about something... totally unrelated to transportation, and he said, it's time for you to learn how to drive a car. And I said, I can't because I'm too nervous and high-strung. And he said, you're too crazy to decide what you can do and what you can't do. That's my job. And I think it's time for you to learn how to call... No, I think it's time for you to call up the California Driving School and learn and have someone come to teach you how to drive a car. And, you know, I knew I could do that. I had taken driving lessons before when I was drinking. I decided I wanted to learn how to drive, and I drove for about 3 weeks and then realized that I was too goofy when I drank to drive, and I was too nervous when I wasn't drinking to drive. So I just... You know, if you have to choose between drinking and driving, I'm going to choose drinking. And so anyway, but I did learn how to drive, and for many years I enjoyed driving, and I finally got on the freeways, and I've driven down here to San Diego many times, especially the northern count part, you know, Oceanside and Carlsbad, because there was quite a back and forth between some of the members of that group and the group that I attend regularly. And I still drive around home, but over the last year or so, I've really had to let go of the idea of driving on the freeway because I'm a little too tentative, and I have neuropathy in the bottom of my feet, and I wear thick-soled shoes, and my legs are heavy from because I'm kind of fat, and also because my circulation is all that great. So now I'm tentative, and then by the time I finally decide, heaving that big leg from one pedal to the other, it goes slow. So I'm letting other people do the freeway driving, and I'm... So very much thank you guys for making this possible. I feel obliged to be fascinating because of all the effort you've gone to, but I'm really, but bear with me, I'm not really all that interesting. I attended my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous August 4th of 1969, and I haven't had anything to drink or taken psychiatric medication from then until now. And I'm very grateful for that. I started drinking. I'm kind of a late bloomer. I didn't start to drink until after I got out of high school. I was born and brought up in Northeast Iowa. I know there's quite a few Iowans moved to California. I think at one time Long Beach had a party for former Iowans, and it got so big they had to break it down into counties. So there might be somebody in this audience from Iowa, but unless you lived in the northeast part of Iowa, you've never heard of old wine. But that's where I grew up. And I was not an unhappy child, but I've always been very uncomfortable. My real name is Marianne Looney. And for some, and anybody, when they hear that, at first chuckles, you know. But it's something that people get used to. They don't ponder it forever. My brother was able to marry two quite attractive women who were more than willing to call themselves Mrs. Looney. My father and mother were married until my father died from 1940 to 1987. And my dad died in 1987, and she was perfectly happy to be Mrs. Looney. But for whatever reason, I felt that as long as my name was Looney, that meant I was crazy. And I have always known there was something off-kilter about me, but I didn't know what it was. To this day, I don't, you know. I treat my alcoholism and hope that the other stuff takes care of itself. But anyway, I was kind of lucky. Like I said, I grew up in a family, a fairly benign family. I don't know how madly in love my parents were with one another, but they got along fairly well. And I had a little brother that I liked real well. I have only one sibling, and I liked him real well. And I always had friends. I always had people to run around with, people that I liked. And so I was very grateful for that. And I, I went to Olwine is not a big city, but the high school is fairly good size. But I went to the small Catholic school, and I'm very grateful for that. I still have some friends. Two of my girlfriends made the trip out here to help me celebrate my 45th birthday because they came to help me celebrate my 40th, and they were so impressed they came back again, and they're already planning on my 50th. So. But anyway, another thing that I had always thought from the time I was a little girl, I had kind of thought that I was going to become a celebrity. We had a store back in Owine called the Children's Store, and it was just exactly what it said. It was a store that catered to clothes for children's size clothing. And one day, my mother and I were in there, and two of the sales ladies looked at me and said to each other, "She looks like Margaret O'Brien, doesn't she?" Now, most of you in this room are probably too young to remember Margaret O'Brien, but she was a very important child star back in the 40s and early 50s. And when I heard that, you know, that registered with me right away, and it occurred to me that I was going to become a movie star. And unfortunately, by the time I graduated from high school, I had not been discovered for the movies, and I had to do something, because in the late 50s, I don't think there were all the safety nets that there are now, and also there was not quite as much emphasis on everybody going to college, because it was not everybody was going to go for various reasons. But at high school graduation, when I was growing up, you were expected either to be engaged to be married, getting a job, or going to secretarial school, or going to college, doing something. And I didn't know what to do with myself because I hadn't been discovered. My mom was a hairdresser, and we'd had one room, and from the time I was, I think, about 13 or 14 years old, wherever we lived, there was always one room of the house that was known as Mary's Beauty Shop. And people came and went, and we got used to pulling hair, the color of which was not always our own, out of our food, and casting it aside, smelling permanent wave lotion, and that sort of thing. So I thought, well, I'll go to become a hairdresser. I have absolutely no talent for hairdressing, which is just as well. My hair is falling out. I'm going to be as bald as an egg in another couple of years. But I did go off to hairdressing school, and I graduated, and I worked for a while. But the significance is that I hadn't been there very long when I was invited out on a blind date, a double date, with some people a little bit older than I was. They drank, so I did too. And I remember at first I thought, well, this is okay, and we got something to eat because I knew I was getting a little tiddly, and so I told them. And but I kept on drinking, and all of a sudden I went from a sensible girl who says, "I'm starting to feel this," to a drunken crazy person. As the book describes us, the alcoholic is very rarely mildly intoxicated. He is always more or less insanely drunk, and that's what happened to me the first time, and almost every time I drank. I knew what I was doing I knew I was being obnoxious, for lack of a better term, but I couldn't stop. I was powerless right from the beginning. And, you know, the next day, to me, my first hangover, I think, is as significant as my first drunk. Because I think anybody inexperienced with drinking, I'm sure that everybody who made a fool out of themselves the first time they had anything to drink probably is not a member of Alcoholics Anonymous or dying on Skid Row of alcoholism. There's probably a lot of people got drunk and made spectacles of themselves and learned. Somebody came up to me that day, a man who I otherwise respected, and said to me, "I heard about how you acted last night when you were drinking, and do you think you might be one of those people who just shouldn't drink?" And my response was, "Yes, but." I started defending my right to drink right from the very beginning. And the second time I had a chance to drink, I remember that some boys joined us. We were in Des Moines taking our state boards to graduate from beauty school, and some boys joined us, and I don't know what I said to them or how I was behaving. I only know that one of the women that I was with, one of the young girls that I was with, felt constrained to apologize to these boys for how I was acting while I was still there. And so I very early on became the kind of person people felt comfortable talking about when I was still in their midst. I graduated from beauty school and I got a job, and I wasn't very good at that job, so I got another one, and I wasn't good at that one. And I went back to school. I thought maybe if I had some more training. And strangely enough, when I went back to school for a brush-up course, they didn't charge me, but they kind of had me training some of the other students that hadn't graduated yet, and I'm a much better hairdressing teacher than I am a hairdresser. I wasn't half bad at teaching, but anyway, I went off and I got a job, and I did actually work. I worked up a little clientele and everything, but I just couldn't resist the opportunity to move back to Cedar Rapids, which to me was like going to Chicago. It was the big city, and I went back to Cedar Rapids, and I started going out, and I got tangled up with a married man, it was the first time, but it wasn't the last, and I got mixed up with him, and things got bad, and I had to go back home and live with my folks. And my dad sat down with me one night and said, "You can live any way you want to, but if you're going to be here at home, you have to live in such a way you don't embarrass us." And I knew that I had to do something about my drinking, so I stopped. Well, actually, I controlled it for a while. I drank three beers or three mixed drinks, but I had to stop at three. And anybody that's tried that knows how dreary it is. And so I just quit drinking entirely, which is good on one hand, and on the other hand, it gives me an opportunity to start thinking. And my thought process is skewed because, you know, on the one hand, I'm very practical and sensible and always have been. I'd worked. I managed money fairly well. I've had a charge account one place or another since I was 15 or 16 years old, and it never occurred to me not to pay it, and that sort of thing. But on the other hand, I'm a bit of an idiot, and I decided that I could still become a movie star. And so I also on the practical side know that I'm not a big city girl. Like I said, Cedar Rapids was big enough for me. So I found an exciting Cedar Rapids. I moved to Las Vegas. And at the time that I moved, this was 1963, at the time that I moved there, Las Vegas was a very exciting city, but there was only about 80 or 90,000 people living there. I rented a room in a house on 7th Street, and I lived across the street from Las Vegas High School, the only high school in Las Vegas. So that's what the size of the city I was living in, and I was able to get around. And, you know, 3 days after I got there, I started drinking, and a couple months after that, I was in the county hospital mental facility, taking Thorazine and explaining myself to a psychiatrist. And I was in that hospital for a month, and I believe my folks came. I haven't told this story in a long time. My folks came to pick me up because when they found out I was in the mental hospital, they decided to come and take me home. And I remember just as I was about to say, "Okay, I'll come home." I didn't want to, but I thought, "What am I going to do?" Just about the time I said was ready to say, "Okay, I'll come home," my dad said, "Okay, you can stay, but we can't help you anymore. Don't call us with any of your troubles." And I was so relieved, and I was able to stay in Las Vegas, and I went to the mental hospital a couple more times after that, once for a week and once overnight. And I've been in jail a few times. Once a time I was in jail and I was real thirsty, and it was the next morning after I had made a terrible scene in the jail and woke everybody up, and I was afraid people would be mad at me because I've got a big mouth and I can scream and holler, but I couldn't fight my way out of a wet paper sack. And some of these girls in that jail were kind of tough, and I was so afraid that they were going to beat me up for being a nuisance. So when I got thirsty that morning, I didn't know what to do, so I drank water out of the toilet bowl. And I'm going to tell that story until somebody eventually comes up and identifies with me. Now, I've had people... There's just got to be some. My case can't be that different. People have come up and told me they didn't drink water out of the toilet bowl, but they used it to do something and to shoot dope with, apparently. And then one lady admitted to splashing water on her face from the toilet bowl, but I'm talking about... But anyway, remember, I left Cedar Rapids and went back to Olean because of a man. I had to leave Las Vegas and come over to Southern California because of a man. And it wasn't these men's fault. They were never any crazier than I was. It's just that the one guy was married, and then when he looked like he was going to get a divorce, I thought, "Oh, shucks." You know. I might get saddled with him, you know. And the one in Las Vegas wasn't any crazier than I was, but he was bigger. And I'm kind of a provocateur, and I was afraid eventually he was going to hurt me. And so this psychiatrist, who quite frankly understood me, and I knew it, one of the things in my life that I'd always been able to say either right to people or under my breath is, you don't understand. And for whatever reason, when I talked to this man and he responded to me, I knew that he understood me. And if my problems were strictly mental and emotional, and I have both, I have emotional problems and I have mental quirks, if that was it, I would not have needed alcohol. He would have had an answer for me, because he was able to see some of the things that were upsetting me and see the legitimacy in it. He said, you've got enough trouble. Call yourself something else. And he got me to change my name, and it helped. There's nothing, you know, if there was a law came out today that said that you, unless you were married or had some show business reason to do it, you had to go by your regular name. If I had to call myself Marianne Mooney today, I wouldn't care, and you could laugh all you wanted to, and I'd go, ha, 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 funny, isn't it? And it wouldn't bother me a bit. But when I was 23 years old and full of self-obsession and self-confidence and self-loathing, saying my name was hard. It was so hard that it made sense. And also I was promiscuous and not taking any precautions, and I was in no position, there would be no happy ending at my age and the state I was in to have a pregnancy, and he encouraged me to do something about seeing to it that that didn't happen. And I did both of those things, and I felt better. But you know what, and I don't think it'll surprise anybody here, I didn't drink one drop less, because there's something that happens when I drink alcohol that eventually I'm going to need to have done. There's a decompressing or a relaxation that I listened to a tape on the way down here of a woman, and she said her shoulders were always up by her ears. And I don't know that I would have admitted it that way, but I knew exactly what she was talking about, because when I take a drink, suddenly I can breathe again. Suddenly I don't care that my name is Looney. Suddenly I don't care that I have irregular menstrual periods and I think it means that there's something wrong with me and I'm weird. And suddenly none of that matters. And I can talk to men and have a congress with them and not let anything bother me. And eventually that's going to happen, that I'm going to need that. Eventually the fact that alcohol does something for me that I need done always wins. I left Las Vegas in 1965. I was there from August, I think I got there. I left town the 15th of August, the Feast of the Assumption. And I left Old Wine the 15th of August, and I got to Las Vegas probably the 17th or 18th, and I was there until May 6th or 7th of 1965. And I came over to Southern California at the behest of the psychiatrist. He told me, because I asked him, and he said he'd been doing everything he could think of to get me out of Las Vegas, because he probably knew stuff about Las Vegas that I didn't know, because that's when the mafia still ran Las Vegas. And it isn't that you couldn't be a young crazy girl in Las Vegas, but I was so goofy that I could have got myself mixed up with some people that could have really hurt me, and I wouldn't have even known what was going on. And because I had a big mouth and I threw myself at people and did stupid things. So I think that he knew that there was going to be real trouble if I stayed there in Las Vegas. And so I guess to come over here to Los Angeles with the hippie dippies was And anyway, I left Las Vegas under the and snuck out of Las Vegas to get away from this guy. And I've lived up in Santa Monica ever since. And when I first got here, I didn't like it, because I loved Las Vegas and I resented being run out of town. And I got a little job working in a tavern, and that didn't, you know, I worked in a couple, three taverns. And then one day I got a job in a coffee shop, and I was supposed to be the hostess, and I ended up, or supposed to be the cashier, and I ended up being a waitress. And I had tried waitressing before and liked it, but I wasn't any good at it. But for some reason or another, I just fell in love with this job, and I was determined to hang on to it, and I held on to waitressing. I was a waitress for 38 years, and I remember my boss trying to get rid of me. They'd hired me, and I wasn't all that great, but they kept hiring people to take my place. And finally one day I said to him, I was back at our little smoke break place. This is when we all still smoked. And I was back having my cigarette and puffing on my Pall Mall and said, when are you gonna accept the fact that, and let me stay here? And he said, what are you talking about? And I said, I've seen you get people in here to try and replace me and they're not as good as I am. Give me a chance. And you know, he did. And I worked for him until the restaurant closed, when they didn't renew the lease. And I waited table for 38 years. I just, in 2003 was the last time I waited table because of my legs. And, my life in Southern California, whenever I'm speaking, I think I'm in Los Angeles, so forgive me. I know I'm in San Diego. I'm getting a little iffy, but I do know I'm in San Diego. But if I refer to it as Los Angeles, please. You know, it seems like whenever I talk at an AA meeting, I think I'm still in Los Angeles. But anyway, I found a boyfriend that wasn't such a bad guy. And he and I moved in together. And I remember I didn't dislike him, but I certainly wasn't all that madly in love with him once the excitement wore off. But I remember sitting on the steps of this little apartment we had and saying to myself, well, at least I'm living in sin. You know, because I'm... And he and I drifted apart, and like I said, I got this job, and I was really able to take care of myself. I didn't need anybody to chip in, and he and I kind of broke up or just sort of drifted away, and I've met and fell in love with somebody. One of the girls I worked with had a son, and he'd just come home from Vietnam, and he was about 5 years younger than I was, but we met, and we've kind of fell in love. And for the first and only time in my life, I wanted to get married and have a family. And this young man was certainly not unworthy of that affection, but looking back on it, I think what I was trying to do was my last-ditch effort to fix myself, because I had never wanted to marry and have children. I didn't not want it, but it was never... I never once said, if only I got married and had children. But this time, for whatever reason, I wanted to, and I think it was my last-ditch effort to fix myself. Just a little anecdote to tell you what I looked like. I was only 28 years old. I was only 5 days past my 29th birthday when I got sober. So I was only 28 when he and I met and were going together. The bar we usually drank in was closed on Christmas, so we went down the street to another bar. And it was one of those things, and those of you who have tended bar know what this is like. There was just enough customers in there that the guy couldn't justify closing. So he was a little cross in the first place. So when Mike and I went in there, he checked Mike's ID and didn't bother to check me. And he checked Mike's ID and then looked over at me and said, lady, you ought to be ashamed of yourself. I was only 5 years older than he was, and he was a Vietnam War veteran. So, you know, he had a little mileage, too. And so that's what I looked like at 28. He and I were together the night the man landed on the moon. I think that's July 20th. And we had broke up and come back together again, and he'd left me. I hadn't left him. He'd left me. But he'd come back, and I thought it was going to be all right, but my drinking had taken that last irreversible turn, and I was now drinking strictly for medicinal purposes, and he was still able to have fun with his drinking, plus he did a little bit of drugs. Thank God. He did LSD, and he never tried to talk me into it, and I'm so glad. For whatever reason, that practical part of me did not completely die, because I'm pretty good with words, and I know what expanding means. And the idea of expanding what was going on in my mind was not, you know, so... I stayed away from LSD, But on August, he left me, somewhere between the 20th and the 4th of August, he left me. And because I just wasn't any fun anymore. And I was resigned to the fact that I was going to go to work and come home from work and maybe change out of my uniform and maybe not and go right over to Pete's Wilshire House and start drinking. Maybe come home and pass out for an hour or two and go back and start drinking again. Come home and pass out and jerk awake in the middle of the night and be terrified. I didn't drink in the middle of the night and I didn't carry a bottle to work with me in my purse. I'm grateful for that. I didn't make a decision not to do it. It never occurred to me to do it, and I'm very grateful for that, because I might have ruined my liver if I'd have had a way to keep drinking, to keep that panic at bay. But like I said, on August 4th, I woke up, and I don't know what I did until I went to work, but I know that when I got to work that day, I got to work, and I was cleaning off a table in the restaurant, and the thought came to me, why don't you try AA? And I don't know where it came from, but I'm grateful for it, because I came home from work that afternoon, and I said to myself, I stood at the foot of the stairs. I can remember this now. I don't know how totally accurate it is, but it seems like I paused for a moment and said, well, if you're going to go to AA tonight, I guess I won't go over to Pete's this afternoon. I remember saying that, and whether I said it as I ascended the stairs or if I stayed at the foot and made that decision, I don't know. But I went upstairs to my apartment. I called Alcoholics Anonymous. I found out where a meeting was that night. I called them up, and I said, how do you go about joining up? And they told me where a meeting was that night, that I could get to and what time it started. And after that, I called my mom and dad and told them that I believed I had a drinking problem and I was going to try and do something about it. And I was going to go to AA that night. How much time do I have left? 5:15? Okay, I went, I went to the meeting that night, and I was still just enough of a movie star. When I got there, I posed at the doorway, kind of leaned on the door and said, is this the place? That, you know, the two things I remember saying to Alcoholics Anonymous people my first day is, how do you go about joining up, and is this the place? And so I went in and sat down. They showed me to a seat, and after the meeting started, they asked for other alcoholics, and I was encouraged to raise my hand, and they asked for newcomers, and again I was encouraged to raise my hand, and I started to shake real bad, almost like I was having a seizure, and I said, oh, this is ridiculous, I didn't drink that much. I sat through the meeting, and after the meeting they gave me some literature and a big book. And I didn't have, I put a dollar in the basket, but I hadn't brought a lot of money with me, but I did have a checkbook, and I had money in the bank. Like I said, taking financially, I don't have problems. I may not have enough money to do what I'd like to do, but I live within whatever I have, and I always have, drunk or sober. I've never written a bad check in my life. And anyway, I offered to write a check, and they said, oh no, dear, pay us when you can. And I'm almost positive that I paid them back probably the next night. But this year, on my 45th birthday, I went up to 26th and Broadway and said, I'm pretty sure I paid for my original big book, but I'm going to give you some money to pay for a big book today, just so I'll be absolutely sure. I don't know who gave me a ride home. Somebody gave me a ride home, and I went to bed, but I took the literature to bed with me, and I read it, and I was just fascinated by it. I don't talk about this enough, but if you're new, take some of those pamphlets and read them. If you don't want to get involved in the big book right away, I read the big book, but I read the stuff in the back first, the stories. I like the stories, and I wanted to hear what you were doing. That's why I always give a drunkalogue, because I couldn't identify with recovery because I didn't know what recovery meant. But I could see people were doing well, and I wanted to hear what they had been like if I had they been anything like I was. And I read those. I just love those pamphlets, the Jack Alexander article, Fulton Mausler, and the letter to a woman alcoholic, and you know, all. I just read pamphlet after pamphlet that night, and I fell asleep and woke up the next morning to the sound of the alarm clock, and I hadn't slept the night through, and I can't tell you how long. I don't sleep the night through tonight, or nights now, but I did that night, and I was aware of it. I was aware that I'd done that, and I went to work that day, and I think that after I got off work that day, I went to my psychiatrist. I was still seeing a psychiatrist. And I said, I don't know how you're going to feel about this, but I went to my first AA meeting last night, and he said, Mazel Tov. And so so anyway, and then when I got home, my folks were on the telephone calling me to find out how the meeting went that night, because I don't know that my folks knew I was an alcoholic, but I know they'd been very concerned about my drinking, because I behaved badly when I drank. I really did. And so anyway, that was the start of my time in Alcoholics Anonymous. The first lady to help me was a lady named Maj. I never called her sponsor, and she didn't ask me to, but she was a wonderful mentor to me. And a few months after that, I had started to become a little bit entrenched in this really lively group that I'm involved with now. And a young woman named Alice was in her evangelical phase, and she took me on, and people started asking me who my sponsor was, and I went to her one night, and I said, Alice, people are asking me who my sponsor is, and I'm telling them it's you. Is that okay? So that, and you know, the strange part about that is I don't know that I was smarter than Alice, but I know I thought I was. And Alice was a little bit younger than I was. She was 26 and I was 29. And also she had a rather uncomfortable marriage. And I had really no problems at all because my last boyfriend had left me. And I had no problems at all other than stuff going on in my head. But as far as external problems, my folks were thrilled I was in AA. The people I worked with didn't care one way or another. So nobody was bugging me and, oh, you didn't drink that much or anything like that. I was fine. But the thing I remember about that is the idea that I knew that I was smarter than Alice, and yet when she told me to do something, I did it. And my life got better. When she told me to write a fourth step, I wrote one. And strangely enough, by the time I'd finished my fourth step and was ready to take my fifth, she hadn't finished hers yet. Because she was only 6 or 7 months more sober than I was, and she hadn't finished hers yet. So I had to take my fifth step with her sponsor. And then she and I realized it was time for me to find a sponsor that was a little bit farther ahead of me than she was, although we remain friends. And I talk about her every time I speak, because I don't know where she is, and I hope that someday I see her again to thank her and tell her what an important part she played in my life. And Clancy became my sponsor. Not so much for... I'll tell you what I liked. I didn't know whether I liked him or not, because sometimes I didn't. Sometimes I didn't, but I liked the people he sponsored, and I knew that they were following his direction, that they were involved with him, and they were nice to each other, they were nice to me, they were nice to other alcoholics, and they seemed to be enjoying life and making progress, and I wanted what they had, so I asked Clancy to be my sponsor, and like I told you when I first started, he got me to learn to drive a car, something I thought I'd never be able to do, and I don't think it's unrealistic for a woman of 74 with neuropathic feet and a little bit of nervous tension to stop driving on the freeway. I'm still able to get back and forth to meetings. I drive myself to my meetings. I drive myself to get-togethers. I don't, and I give people rides home. There's a couple of people one woman whose eyesight is not good at night after dark, and I drop her off, and a girlfriend of mine that never has driven a car, I drop her off. For several years, I picked up a fella at the VA. Now somebody else is doing it, but there are still things that I can do with the car that aren't selfish things. There are ways that I can give back, because I truly believe that what has saved me in Alcoholics Anonymous, of course, is not drinking and following direction, but the idea that is entrenched in our steps, our traditions, and our concepts. I'm active in general service and have been. That's when I found out we have 12 concepts. That the concepts place an emphasis on being of service to others. Because like I said, that psychiatrist understood me. And I remember talking to him on my third AA birthday. He finally would take a call from me. He wouldn't take any calls from me. He had one day, when I was still drinking, he said, "You think because I've always been nice to you that I have to be, and I'm going to show you that's wrong." And hung up on me, and I knew it was over. I knew he didn't want to talk to me anymore. But I called him every day on my anniversary, but on my third year sober, he called me back, and we were talking to each other. I said, "Doctor, did you know I was an alcoholic?" And he said, "Yes, I did." And I said, "Well, why didn't you tell me?" And he said, "You wouldn't have listened to me." And I said, "Doctor, I almost died." And he said, "Nonsense. People who have never known great unhappiness can never know great joy. It was a good experience for you." Or something to that. I may not be. Dr. Lester, if you're up there, may you rest in peace. But anyway, because psychiatry, as I saw it, I don't know whether psychiatrists really do this or not, because this was before Freud was completely, nobody pays much attention to Freud anymore, except as sort of, is anachronism the word I want? Sometimes I use words I really don't know what they mean. But anyway, Freud was still somewhat in vogue, and there was all this deep psychoanalysis and self-probing. Self-discovery is fine, but I do not drink. The more I learn about myself, the more I drink, and I don't learn about myself and say, "Oh, this is who I am, and this is what I've been doing to assuage my worries about this. Why don't I stop doing that and do something else? That's not what I'm going to do. I'm just going to drink more and say, who cares? Because not caring is as important as, you know, like going to a dance and being scared because you can't dance, and then having a couple drinks and not caring. I didn't dance any better. I just didn't care that I didn't dance good. So I think the emphasis in Alcoholics Anonymous and our fellowship and the program and the steps as they are written are to be of service to others. If, you know, maybe we start out by cleaning ourselves up so we can be of service to others. But the idea that however briefly, I am willing to act in a way that is beneficial to you, allows me to think about you a bit. If I'm giving you a ride, if the only thing I think about you is, oh shucks, I've got to make sure I get Marie tonight, that is, I'm at least thinking about Marie, that I want to make sure Marie gets a ride home, that Dolores gets a ride home. And, you know, that these things, and that I can think about other people besides myself. I don't, because I don't work anymore, and that's been difficult for me. I've earned a wage ever since I was 14 or 15 years old. I haven't always been self-supporting, but I have always, since the time I was 14 or 15 years old, been someone that somebody was willing to pay. And now I don't know. God bless FDR. Because nobody wants me anymore. And nobody is willing to pay me anymore for anything because, you know, I can't walk and I never took any kind of courses that, you know, I can do anything sitting down. So you know, that has been difficult for me. I've had some, you know, some of my stuff is sort of, some of that craziness that I thought had gone away has resurfaced and I have to double up. One of the things I do is stay at home usually until about noon, because a lot of people call me up in the morning, and maybe they have sponsors that are busy at work, or maybe they're just people that have been sober for a while and want to talk to another person that's been sober for a long time. And so I'm available for that. And granted, I talk about myself a lot, and sometimes people call up and say, hi, how are you? And I just take off, and five minutes later. But I'm available for people, and I sponsor more people now than I have before, and I pay attention to them, and I care what happens about them, because I truly believe that that's the difference. That if I just work on myself, I'm going to end up pulling what hair I've got left out. And I don't want to do that. I never did become a movie star, but you know what I'm doing now? Because like I said, I didn't have... Because I don't work anymore, I've got to have something to do now. I go to a lot of meetings in the evening, and I prefer evening meetings. I go to one daytime meeting and some morning meeting on Sunday mornings. I go to that, or I'm in general service on Sunday mornings, but otherwise I go to a Sunday morning meeting. But I prefer the ambiance in the evening meetings. And so anyway, I go to a lot of meetings tonight, but I have a whole day I have to fill up. And at noon, and the phone stops ringing, and I've read the newspaper, and I've done the puzzle. All three puzzles, and I've got my puzzles done. Now what? And so I've had to try to find things to do. And there are certain things I like to do. And now that I'm this old, I'm 74 years old, the fact that I'm not going to be a movie star or a famous singer doesn't matter anymore. So earlier this year, I took a singing class, and it was so much fun. And I was the only country music singer that one other guy sang a country song once in a while, but I was the only Kitty Wells kind of singer. So it was so much fun. And, I mean, I enjoyed it. I had a couple of times I sang, and it was awful. And I finished the song because I made myself a promise that no matter how bad I was, that if I started singing a song, I would finish it. I wouldn't maybe go back to the break and do it more, but I would finish it. And so one time I tried to sing a song that I thought I was going to be able to get the notes because of the adrenaline. And it was called There'll Be No Teardrops Tonight. It's a Hank Williams song that Tony Bennett did. And I loved that song, and I was going to try and do it, and it was awful. So the next week when I went back, I said, you know, I know Hank Williams is still spinning in his grave. And I said, I'm going to try to redeem myself. I did No Teardrops last week. This year, I'm going to do Crying Time. And I hit all the notes on Crying Time, and I had a wonderful time. I was glad I did it. And, you know, because of what I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, I enjoyed listening to the other people, the songs they picked, how they presented them. Some of the people you wonder, what are you thinking? And other people... There was one woman named Marie that I just hung on every word. It was like watching maybe Sophie Tucker or somebody, you know, an older woman sing. She had such pizzazz and such flair. It was just a pleasure to watch her. This year, I decided to do something. I'm taking a senior's acting class for commercials. And I'm not bad at it, you know, because we do a lot of reading aloud and we do a lot of public speaking. So I'm not bad at this, and I don't care whether I ever get a job or not. If I can get up there and read that commercial and the teacher says, good job, that's enough. That's enough. And I'm very glad to do it. And we had a little exercise the other day, and I wrote a commercial and presented it. And, you know, I painted, I studied the commercials on TV. Now, I don't want to get too much away from AA, but just talking to, about, but I was able to learn something and try to learn something. I've had two serious knee surgeries. One not so serious knee surgery, and one surgery where I shattered my arm in a fall. Every time I go under an anesthetic and come back out, I'm a little dumber. And then, to top it off, I got hit by a bus. And I didn't get hurt real bad, but I did get a concussion, and I've never been quite the same since. And so I'm so grateful that I can still learn something, because I thought maybe I'd never really be able to learn anything again. But the reason, to tie that in, for one thing, I can't spend every waking second in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. And secondly, I have to be willing to get out of self-obsession. And sometimes I need a distraction to get out of self-obsession, because self-obsession is what makes me crazy and makes me think I need something to say I don't care. So I do these things. My golden years are not all that easy, but I'm glad that I'm glad I'm spending my golden years above ground. I have a lot of friends in Alcoholics Anonymous. People have been very good to me. And, you know, when I was a young woman, people liked me okay, but I wasn't held in any particular regard. I was always kind of, the best way I can describe it is what the common thing that people might have said about me was, poor Marianne, you can't help but like her. You know those kind of people where you like them because maybe they've got a little bit of a sense of humor and they're not that unpleasant to look at and that sort of thing. I was kind of like that. And I went to work every day and showed up, and I didn't try to steal your customers away, and I did my share of the side work and sometimes a little extra. So I was not disliked, but I was sort of, number one, pitied and treated quite often with amused tolerance. And now, today, I can say that not only am I respected, I'm respected by people for whom I have some regard. I hold many, many people that I know in very high regard, and the fact that they reciprocate, that they think well of me, is wonderful. Because I'll be honest with you, I don't like myself all that much. But I don't know if it's ever going to change. But I'll tell you what, the fact that I try to behave in such a way that I can travel in this world and be held in some regard and not be annoying to people, and that I can carry this message, that I am somebody who other people who need this message will actually sometimes listen to, is wonderful, and I'm thrilled with it, and may God bless us everyone. It's Tiny Tim.